Water is essential to life, but also agriculture, industry, and energy. It is the foundation of modern civilization, but ever-rising consumption and climate change have many worried there won't be enough to go around. Meanwhile, sea level rise and extreme weather threaten some areas with disaster. How can we avoid conflict and build peace? How can we ensure everyone has what they need to survive and thrive as we march toward a global population of more than 9 billion? You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Water Stories, produced with support from USAID, we interview experts and practitioners from around the world to hear how people are thinking about and addressing water, peace, and conflict challenges. I'm Sean Peoples, and in this interview, we'll hear from Sandra Ruckstall, a social development and governance consultant for the World Bank and the author of USAID's Water and Conflict Toolkit.
So initially, I took an interest in post-conflict development practice. I went back to school. I started drilling down into that. I started working, consulting for the World Bank in this area. And as I started to explore this area and started to work more in the water sector, it became evident to me, first of all, when we're talking about post-conflict programming, I really don't believe in the concept of post-conflict, because conflict is a system, it is a cycle, and the label doesn't do us very much good when we're trying to develop good practice. So then I started to explore more the concept of conflict-sensitive development approaches, which are pertinent to all different kinds of situations, you know, of course, fragility and conflict situations, but also there might be what we would consider normal circumstances where there is latent conflict that we as development practitioners need to be cognizant of when we're developing our strategies and designing programs and implementing them. We need to be thinking about all of that. So with that beginning, I started to realize that on a practical level, it's much broader than just post-conflict programming if we want to be really constructive in development programming to promote peaceful situations and peaceful societies, that we need to take a broader lens and consider all types of programming in all types of places, all types of times.
That viewpoint, do you feel like that's something other people get intuitively? Or is that something that you feel is a job that you have to actually convince people that not only is post-conflict isn't necessarily how you need to think about it, it's a cycle, you need to think of these things as linked. Is that something that you feel is widespread?
When people learn of these approaches and they read the research or the guidance or whatever it is about how to do this in the field, they'll say, yeah, okay, that makes sense. But if it's not built into the business procedures for these programs, so if it's not a requirement for that agency to do things a certain way that ensures that programs are conflict sensitive, then it can be left by the wayside because there are other priorities for the donor. So that's the challenge. People might say, yes, that makes sense, but practitioners have a very full work plate, especially when you're working in conflict situations or fragile situations, because you might be dealing with emergency circumstances. Things have to be done quickly. Resources might be slim, given how much you have to do in a short period of time. So if you try to add in all of these good practices and ask practitioners to do more, that could be a stretch. So it needs to be documented as business practice, that the certain requirements are incorporated. For example, I've done some research on water programming in Yemen. As I analyzed that, I started to probe the monitoring and evaluation systems for these projects. And I interviewed those who were based in the field for the aid agency to do M&E for those projects. It was a separate contractor from those who were implementing the projects, right? Separate contractor for M&E. And we discussed the value of measuring conflict, you know, impact on conflict or fragility during project implementation, even if that might be an indirect impact. Now, this was back in 2011, 2012, right? So this is before the recent events in Yemen. And they definitely, the evaluators definitely saw the value of adding, they said it would take very little effort just to add a question here or there in a questionnaire to survey impacts or effect on societies for, you know, increasing risk of conflict and stuff like that. So they said the investment would be very, very small, but the value would be huge. Yet it was not a requirement. It wasn't, they just kept saying it's not in the terms of reference. It's not in the terms of reference to be asking those questions. I said, well, don't you think it would be good to do it? You, as a professional, recognize it would be good. Yes, but it's not in the terms of reference. So that comes right down to we really need to make it part of our business practice to include this, you know, these considerations of conflict, impact on conflict, or even potential for peace building in the systems and the strategies and designs of our projects. We have to make it explicit. And those instructions may have to come straight from the donor, right, in part.
But I want to point to Bizwater Toolkit, your lead author on this. Give me a sense of what this toolkit's all about. Mm-hmm. How did you come to be the lead author? Mm-hmm.
So USAID had done a series of toolkits for relating to conflict on forests, youth, and so forth. And there was a need for a toolkit on water and conflict. So with that idea in mind, but this was, you know, this is a big topic area that has been growing over time. So what we ultimately determined that the toolkit would consist of is a focus on conflict and conflict mitigation, but also peace building. So this is like I said, a very vast topic area. So it was trying, so it we found sort of the expanse of that, but set some boundaries around it to provide some guidance on how people can understand what are the risks of conflict in the project they might be implementing or designing, and then what are some tools or some guidance to work towards a constructive outcome. So the challenge in a toolkit like this is you want to make it usable for anybody, okay? So it needs to be general, it needs to be, you know, developed or to help people figure out some transferable lessons, how to apply it to their circumstances. It's very difficult to write something that is both advanced and simple at the same time. So it is really, I guess the point is, it's meant for a very broad audience to be able to look at this and look at all of these different categories of issues and components of intervention to facilitate peace building or mitigate conflict. To look at those categories that we've developed in the toolkit and apply them to your context. So to look at it almost as a menu and say, okay, here's an issue that applies to my context. That one doesn't, that one does, that one doesn't. And it helps you, as a practitioner, immerse yourself in it in real time based on the circumstances where you're working. And then we also went to great lengths to document practical examples of what might be the components of an intervention, some characteristics of a project design that can help to facilitate peace building or mitigate conflict. So, and then there's a rapid appraisal framework at the end of the toolkit that is also meant to be a sort of quick and dirty way for people to walk through, sort of to sort of visualize and do a quick back of the envelope analysis for themselves of how all of these concepts apply to their circumstances, because resources can be slim when it comes to doing this kind of analysis and injecting these concepts into a project design. This toolkit is meant to simplify that so that any practitioner of any kind of background, but also a policymaker, can look at this and build from, again, coming back to tacit knowledge, build from what they know to figure out how to make a program sensitive to conflict and constructive in building peace. So sort of the approach of what the toolkit is intended to do.
For you personally, what did you get out of writing that? Were there perceptions that changed? Were there things, was there a change? Was there, I mean, did you already know all this stuff? What did you learn in writing this or putting this together?
One of the things that I learned, or maybe has been reinforced in a lot of the different research we've done on this topic of conflict and water and conflict-sensitive development approaches in water programming, is that we have lots of assumed peaceful outcomes from projects, but very little of it has been measured and documented. So as we try to provide examples, practical examples that practitioners can model in their own projects, this is based on a lot of more sort of general reflections that might be in final reports and documents and things like that. We did some talking with practitioners about their experiences and the outcomes, but this is the kind of information is not, these outcomes are not well documented, like I said, and they're not well measured. So in doing this, we're still working with a lot of assumptions. We're grounding them more and more with these examples, but we would do a real service to the field if we really started documenting and measuring this kind of information so that we can inform better and better practice in this area.
One of the things that I think is important, and you keep hitting on it too, is this idea that a practitioner who's working on the ground is already dealing with so much. Mm-hmm. How does this help them? How does this toolkit help them get through the clutter a little bit? Mm-hmm. How does this work to reinforce why it's so important to document, mm-hmm. why it's so important to have something, a template to work from?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, one of the foundational points in the toolkit is the concept of do no harm. So this is transferable across the field of development, okay? So working from there and reaffirming the significance of that concept and building from there, I think this toolkit, because we try to categorize things very simply, is meant to be a thinking guide that does not require a degree in complex studies or something like that. It's meant to be very easily digestible and applicable. So it's meant to facilitate faster solution building. Now, you can work with a conflict specialist with this toolkit and do bigger things in terms of analysis and so forth, but you really don't need to be that kind of specialist to apply these concepts. It's really meant to be workable at that level.
If you're not a practitioner that works solely on conflict or solely on water, do you think this holds value for practitioners who maybe are working on health mm-hmm. or who are working on different sectors? Does a toolkit like this shed some light? Is it helpful for someone not working in the sectors that may be obvious at first to read through this? Does mm-hmm. it hold value there?
That's an excellent point, because the issue with water is it has multi-sectoral implications. So this toolkit covers the whole water sector, from agriculture to water supply and sanitation and so on. So that, again, was one of the challenges in writing it, was we were covering the whole sector. So I think for folks who are working on food security programming or who are working on health programming, where they touch on the water sector, where they touch on water supply for any, you know, for these types of activities, then this toolkit certainly has utility. The toolkit also talks quite broadly. I already mentioned the broad concept of do no harm. So that has utility for everybody. But then in addition to that, it speaks quite a bit about governance. When we're talking about peace building, we're boiling it down to collaborative governance. And that also is transferable to different sectors. So I think it would have utility to for a variety of sectors and for multi-sectoral programming.
Well, what's the importance of working in a multi-sectoral approach?
The challenge with multi-sectoral approaches, or let me start with the importance. The importance of multi-sectoral approaches is when we are designing and implementing some development investment, we're injecting ourselves into a system, okay? Where all of these things of water management, health, food, even getting into other public services as well. All of this stuff is interconnected, and the benefits of reducing poverty and reducing vulnerabilities in communities, all of this is interconnected. How those pieces fit together obviously vary place to place and from point in history to point in history. So, and water connects to so many of these, right? Because the development impacts, you know, domino into a variety. Very easily we can measure how those domino into other sectors. Now, how do we do this? Again, because folks in the field are overburdened with a variety of requirements and expectations from the donors. So how do we do this in practice? It's incumbent upon us as practitioners to learn how to bridge from discipline to discipline and to think critically about connecting from sector to sector. And that begins at the strategy level, macro strategy level, and then at the project strategy level and project design and through to implementation. There aren't a lot of good examples or practices of how this should be done. It really is the burden of the practitioner. So what we need to do is find incentives for people to do that. So a sector expert in water or a water engineer or an environmental scientist or whatnot, whoever's working on the project, can figure out how to communicate from discipline to discipline and sector to sector during all those phases of the project. How can this be done? And we can say in a perfect world, we have teams that represent all these areas of expertise. But the responsibility is on us to understand how to do it. When doing this kind of research, and I talked about the importance of monitoring and evaluation and documenting all of these lessons and so forth. When doing this kind of research on practice and trying to document, you know, all these innovations that have happened in the field and so forth, we're very good at documenting, like I said, good practice, these stories, these success stories. But we aren't very good at documenting all of these lessons that have happened because people are shy to share their lessons. And frankly, when we're talking with implementers in the field, I, as a researcher, they can be extremely shy to talk with me because I've been assumed to be an auditor in the field when I'm asking these questions about experiences and practices and lessons learned and so forth. They can be very shy because, so the system of how implementers work with a donor creates actually is a barrier to learning because they will report what is required and want to report best stories, for example, and all the goodness. So there's a limit to learning. There's really a limit to learning because of that relationship between donor and implementer. And I think it would be beneficial for donors to find a way to crack that nut so the implementers don't feel that they'll be punished for telling all the lessons that they've learned. It's just it's a consideration also when we think about business practice and what should be documented and how.
I kind of want to get a broader context on why consider gender, but also get your thoughts on how in your work it's starting to become a consideration that you have to be intentional.
When we're designing any kind of project in the field, we have to consider the stakeholders who are involved. And of course, when it comes to communities, when it comes to governance institutions, in many circumstances, these are male dominated. That means that benefits to women, the constructive role women can play in the household, in these governance institutions, in decision making for things like water allocation or, you know, all of a variety of things, that knowledge and that capacity of women can be missed. So there's a lot of interest to figure out, okay, how do we articulate the value of women's participation, women's knowledge, and so forth? Because that requires an additional investment, again, by implementers, by the host community or the government institutions you might be working with in the field or whoever. This is an extra, you're asking them to do more by including more people. Now, here we're talking about women, of course, but there are a variety of marginalized groups we could be talking about in truth. But in the case of women, here we're asking them to include a group that may have been neglected in the past. And that means a better understanding of why. Why am I going to put that labor in? Why am I going to make that investment to bring women into this in a new and better way? You know, what's the value? What's the return on that investment? So there's some education that's required. Then, I mean, there are all sorts of sort of cultural barriers that might have to be overcome in that process. But there's a general understanding on the very highest level in development practice that we need to understand the distributional impacts of any investment. That means men and women, disaggregating even to that level in a better way. Then as we go back up the chain to project design, we need to figure out how to lay the groundwork so that, you know, we prevent a disparity in those, you know, the distribution of those impacts between men and women. So there's an interest there for these, for all of these reasons, and we're trying to find new ways to specifically apply this in the water sector. A lot of that guidance in the past has focused on water supply and sanitation guidance. Now, when it comes to water resource management, and you know, issues of transboundary management and things, there's very little guidance that, very little analysis that's been done on sort of how, what's the value of including women in that part of water programming and in those types of investments.
Right. For a practitioner just starting out, mm-hmm. what's the three pieces of advice you would give someone?
So first and foremost, going back to sort of how I got into this field, it's, we can't consider this, you know, this to be a didactic relationship between water and conflict. We need to think more broadly about conflict-sensitive approaches to development and how that applies to all circumstances. Right. This is good practice in all cases. So with that, there are three parts of understanding sort of the opportunities for being conflict-sensitive when building and implementing programs. When we're preparing those interventions, there are the three big things that you're intervening on are, first, systems of power in that context. When you're going into a context, always think about the systems of power that relate to water access. Okay, so it could be water access for any purpose, for growing food, for washing your hands and, you know, basic hygiene in the house, for whatever. So what are the systems of power that enable and constrain access? That's one. Two, governance institutions. How are they characterized? Because these are the mechanisms that, if we think about the informal and the formal governance mechanisms, that characterize that system of power. So we need to think about governance institutions because we want to make those collaborative, so that we can ensure the proper distribution of benefits to stakeholders. So that being the third part is about, we need to think about the qualitative and quantitative impacts an investment might have, not just in the near term when we're thinking about, you know, these outputs of how much pipe was laid, how many, you know, taps are open, so forth and so on. But we need to think broader, big picture in terms of those impacts. And that brings in impacts in other sectors and linkages with other investments in other sectors as well. So the third part being about that distribution of benefits. Those are the three areas that I think we always need to be critical of and always come back to are systems of power, governance, institutions, and those the distribution of benefits. Those are three things that need to be reflected upon.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit our website, newsecuritybeat.org.